So here we are, episode two. If you tuned into episode one, thank you very much indeed. It's gone down a lot better than I expected. But in case you missed it, we released a mini episode, which was a sort of add-on to episode one. And it featured a short discussion on the use of medieval settings in the fantasy genre, which is a very, very hot topic at the moment.
All in all, I think it went good. The first episode, we had a lot of extra material, so we spun that off into extra little episode, mini episode, focusing on specifically medieval European settings and the overuse of European culture and historical background. And I think the response we got to the first episode was good. We got some good comments, some good questions. Speaking of which, we had that hanging contest out there for a listener to send in a good question that we're going to address here on this podcast. And I actually want to mention two names. The first is not necessarily not our contest winner, but Daniel Mellor had a really good question that actually we're going to address in a later episode. We kind of already had intended to get into talking about pacing and foreshadowing. So we'll actually get at that topic specifically later. But
nice one, Dan.
For our reader or listener question that is going to win our little prize pack, that goes to Keith Cruteau, who had the question, are there any tropes or cliches that you've used and then regretted or wish you had handled differently?
Good question, Keith.
So I don't know about you, but I've, especially early on when I was writing, I've relied on tropes quite a bit, because just getting used to writing and getting into the feel of building fantasy worlds. In particular, my first book, In the Valley of Magic, I was doing something structurally different with that book. It's a what I call a short story novel. So each chapter is a different character with a sort of internal chapter character arc. But all the chapters flow together into one linear plot. So it's kind of like reading a novel, but it's also kind of like reading a short story collection. And I felt that that was going to be a little bit jarring for the reader. So I didn't go as deep in you making my characters in my world perfectly unique. So there are Terry Pratchett, TN type Watchmen characters in the story. Mm-hmm. And there's also Beardy Wizards, as you call them. And those two groups particularly probably could have used a little bit more nuance and a little bit more depth in understanding who these characters are and what they make them different than your standard fantasy Watchman or standard fantasy wizard. What about you?
Yeah, well, on the subject of short stories, I was writing a short story probably a couple of years ago now, and the first draft of it was just elves, you know what I mean, just Tolkien elves, and I just couldn't bring myself to accept that was what I'd settled with, so I had to scrap them in the end, and I rewrote the whole story, and hopefully it came out a bit better. It's in my new short story book, actually, which has just come out. So
what's the name of that book? You forgot the name of your book.
The name of the book, I couldn't remember it.
Isn't it Flying Something Something?
Yeah, Flying on the Ground, it's called. And the short story in question is called The General. It's a fantasy story, obviously. So I came up with a whole new race. And it was quite fun to do, actually. And it's something I've experimented with recently, another short story with orcs. And I think it's more satisfying. I don't know about you. Do you find it more satisfying when you come up with something original and you really end up liking it?
Yeah, I think it depends. So when I took over Of Metal and Magic, we were still just developing the world and kind of pondering things. And the plan was to use very conventional races. So literally calling them elves and dwarves and centaurs. And I wanted to move away from that. So I think, yeah, we've moved away from that, and we've started building a system where you can have different types of races, but they're new and they're original to that world. But races do have their uses. I wrote a flash story called The Performance of a Lifetime, and it's only 1,200 words or 1,500 words or something. It's very short. There's no time for world building or racial development. So I used goblins, and they're green, icky goblins, and they do goblin things. But there was just no space for doing. I needed a villain that this roguish character, plays off on, and goblins were the thing. And so now it works in flash fiction. When you don't have time to really develop ideas, it helps to have tropes that people are familiar with.
Yeah, reference points, like you say. Things that can say a lot without saying very much at all. But now back to the topic at hand, tropes in fantasy. In episode one, we looked at the negative side, the terrible cliches that riddle the genre. And this week, we're going to look at how we can use the tropes that we've just been discussing in a positive way.
Yeah, so I think there's an important difference that is often made. So there's cliches, which are tired and overdone and typically need to be avoided. And then there's tropes, which are conventional ideas to a genre, which may or may not be cliche, depending on how you use them. So this episode, we'll look at employing tropes and employing common fantasy ideas, but trying to do them in a different way that is unique and interesting.
So in the last episode, JM, we did dedicate quite a bit of time to talking about the different races in the fantasy genre. And we were quite negative about it, really. And it's quite reassuring to see that a lot of fantasy writers, contemporary fantasy writers, have taken taken steps to change things. So, I mean, one race in particular that I've seen used in very different ways in more sort of recent fantasy is with elves. The traditional Tolkien idea of an elf is the forest-loving, pointy-eared, awesome with bows creatures that have become like really popular. To be fair, they are like a really likable sort of race, and the Lord of the Ring movies, I think, sort of added to that. So, as a sort of writer, if you're looking for something that people like, then you can see the popularity of elves, and that's the appeal of copying, ripping it off, which is, like I said, something that I almost done and just didn't feel comfortable doing really in the end. So in more contemporary fantasy, we're starting to see the evolution of the archetype of the elf and other kind of character races. And one of my favourite elves, if you will, is in James Barclay's Chronicles of the Raven, which features as one of the main characters an elf who's proficient with magic, as are most elves in the fantasy genre. But he's also very gritty, he's flawed, and he's just struggling like everybody else. So that main elf character is called Ilkar. And like you see throughout, little hints at his classic, the classic elf tropes, you know, like how that they're really old. So there's often jokes about how old he is, though you never find out how old he actually is. And like I said, he's very good at magic, which is again sort of an elf trope. And I haven't really read much of Barclay's other series, but I understand that in one of them he completely twists that sort of archetype of an elf and makes them dark and twisted, sort of like what you see in the dark elves in Skyrim, the Elder Scrolls games. If you ever played them, JM.
The Elder Scrolls game, yeah.
Yeah, I love the Elder Scrolls game.
I think the best Dark Elves, though, come from the Dungeons & Dragons.
Oh, yeah, good shows.
The really Dark Elves that worship the Spider Queen and live underground. And speaking of elves, I mentioned in the last one, the Dragon Age series does a good thing with elves where they use elves to create a class structure, where the humans are the dominant class and the elves are all, at least the city elves are all usually servants or generally poor. And instead of being tied to magic, where every elf is a magic user, they're all kind of seen as roguish. Oh, you're an elf, you're probably a thief of some sort.
That's quite drawing parallels, really, to modern society. You know what I mean? It's very clever. And it's a good way of getting across themes and messages as well. By sort of playing on them, sort of different attitudes that different races have towards one another. I suppose Tolkien sort of flirted with the idea with dwarves and elves, didn't he? So the hatred towards them. So I think that the main lesson we can take away from writers like Barclay is that just because there's a standard, these tropes are seen as that standard, and just because that is the standard of the genre doesn't mean it has to be followed. There's so many different ways that you can change things up. I mean, one of the best examples of a completely new race structure in a fantasy world was done by Adrian Tchaikovsky in Shadows of the Apt. And in that, he bases races off insects. So we've got the tough, hard-working beetles, the graceful and fierce mantids, the aggressive wasps, and the mysterious and just generally weird moths. And each race has its own traits, its own abilities, and they each interact with each other in different ways. And it's just really refreshing to read something that's just not the same, not what you used to, you know what I mean? It's everything's a bit new and different, and it's well worth it.
Does he literally call them beetles and wasps and moths?
Yeah, mantids.
Huh.
Things like that. And I don't know, it works. So they're sort of like hybrid humanoids, if you get me. So they're not sort of giant
anthropomorphic.
People. Yeah.
I think another really good example of an original race that I've read comes from Star Wars. And I mentioned Star Wars a lot. It might be confusing some folks out there, but Star Wars definitely is fantasy. It's space fantasy. It's not science fiction. There's not a lot of science to Star Wars. Yeah. It's all magic through technology. And maybe we'll address something like that in a later episode of where the division between science fiction and fantasy exists. But I think you look at it flatly, Star Wars is definitely space fantasy. And there's a series of books in the old expanded universe that came out in the 90s, and a villain race called the Yushan Vong. And these characters are, if I remember them correctly, their true form is some sort of insectoid or very weird looking characteristic. But the thing that's interesting about the Yushan Vong is they have these other aliens that they have a kind of symbiotic relationship with that they actually wear as disguises. So they manipulate this other race of aliens and they put them on, and it allows them to disguise themselves as humans or other type creatures. It's a really crazy idea.
I think as writers, what we can take away is that when you go to that effort of trying to put in an original spin on things or shake up the tropes, it's appreciated by readers. You've made that effort. So for me, I'd always encourage a bit of originality. So another common trope I've seen recently sort of spun on its head is the boy prince. So by this, I sort of mean the young prince that's not so much a fan of his fortunate position, and he yearns for more freedom or for something he can't have. And then all of a sudden is thrust into a position of responsibility that he isn't quite ready for. And that's the general vibe of the cliche, I think. And it's always to do with the monarchy as well. There's a lot of focus on that. I suppose I don't want to talk too much about the negatives, so instead I'm going to talk about an example I've come across recently that's just shook up that tried and tested trope. That was a bit of a tongue twister there. Tried and tested trope. And it's a story by Joe Abercrombie. The book's called Half a King, and it's a coming of age tale about young Prince Yavi. He has a deformed hand, and as a result of this, he's branded a cripple, a bit similar to Tyrion Lannister, who I'm going to come on to in a little bit. So because of all the scorn that Yavi's everyone throws at Yavi, he's just rejected the idea of becoming a king, and all of a sudden, fate thrusts him into the role of the king. And there are some who will not accept him for who he is, basically remove him straight away, and leaves Yavi in a position where he's chased out of his home. But he's got this sort of attachment, this sort of desire to reclaim what is essentially rightfully his. I suppose it's perfect for a coming of age tale, because that sort of petulant young prince has just found himself having to grow up very, very quickly, and he learns a lot of lessons in the meantime, which make him a better person. So that's a good example. And I mentioned Tyrion Lannister before. I mean, he's not a prince as such, but I think he kind of falls into this category as sort of privileged son of a lord, rich lord. And obviously he's branded a cripple too. And I don't know, I don't want to go too much into about Tyrion Lannister, because I'll be talking for ages. But he is one of my favourite characters in the fantasy genre. It's just, he's the antithesis of the trope.
But like half a king, so Prince Yavi, what makes him different? Other than being a cripple, which is kind of a trope of itself and at this point of its own. So Tyrion Lannister, I think you can say he is different from the typical boy prince trope, just because so much bad happens to him and nothing seems to go right. And he's always on the sharp end of the sword, having to think his way through problems, and his heritage does nothing to help him. It's actually a burden to him. So I think that's what makes Tyrion Lannister a more compelling character. So those all create conflicts for the character that just help that character develop. And you see a lot of change from the beginning of the story to the end of the story in Tyrion Lannister's character, just because of all those conflicts that he has to overcome because of his heritage, rather than being solved by his heritage.
So here, essentially, what we've got is a complete shake-up of the tried and tested trope. We've still got the reluctant prince, but it's not through petulance that he found himself reluctant. He's actually been horribly rejected by his own people. And he finds himself bound to it. Something that he never wanted, and he's hell bent on getting it back.
So I'm going to take my few minutes here to focus on one work in particular, one story in particular. And I think there's a lot of examples of books and stories that take tropes and take them in a different direction or invert them. One example that gets a lot of credit is All the Birds in the Sky by Charlie Jane Anders. It won the 2017 Nebula Award for Best Novel. And Anders takes a bunch of different common fantasy and science fiction tropes. Her book has a wizard school in it, but it's not really a good place to be. It's not definitely not a conducive learning environment. And then one of the kind of underlying tropes in her book is the prophesized hero. One of the main characters comes across a bunch of birds. I think they're called the Parliament, and they tell her that she has, the destiny to protect nature from the evils of mankind, or something equivalent to that. But instead of using that as the driving force of her book, Anders kind of drops that and then forgets about it. And the character just continues on being a relatively normal girl. So it's an interesting way to set up a trope and then to not go where the reader is expecting you to go based on it being a common and well-known trope. I'm not exactly sure if I personally like what she did, because I think that that prophecy and that destiny is always kind of hanging out there in the back of the reader's mind as you're reading through this novel, and it basically seems like it's being ignored by the author. But it's definitely a different way of tackling that idea or addressing that idea. No, but that's not the work in question that I want to focus on. I actually want to focus on one of the earliest stories I remember interacting with that really kind of brought me into the fantasy world, and that's Chrono Trigger. So for those of you who don't know, Chrono Trigger is a Japanese-style RPG game from the early 90s that came out on the Super Nintendo system, and it is regarded as one of the best role-playing games, one of the best games, period, of all time, in large part because of the brilliant story. And one of the things that Chrono Trigger does, the writers of Chrono Trigger, one of the things they do is they set up a lot of common tropes, and then they twist them or they take them in a different direction, and they leave you with an unexpected result. This kind of came to mind as I was reading an article on Tor.com by Peter Tyrius, who was writing about replaying the game and his experience of replaying the game and interacting with the story again and noticing all these things that he didn't notice before. So one of the tropes that you encounter early on in the game is the damsel in distress, or the princess who needs rescuing. And this is set up pretty clearly that it's going in one direction early on in the game. One of the characters, the female character, falls into trouble, and the hero, whose name is Chrono, has to actually travel back in time to chase after her and rescue her. And it's all this, it's a very blatant setup of a typical the boy hero has to rescue the girl type story. Although when he arrives back in time, he finds that she is perfectly safe and she's in the castle and everything's okay. And where the player is kind of given this shock that the story didn't turn out the way they were expecting. They were expecting to be the rescuer, and all of a sudden everything's fine. And then the princess disappears. And what's interesting about this is in the end, the princess needs to be rescued, but she doesn't need to be rescued because she cannot defend herself or she's weak. It's not any question of the princess's own agency. She's just disappeared and she no longer exists to defend herself. And then in order to go rescue the princess, Chrono is joined by his friend, who is another female character and just a brilliant inventor who invented all the time machine stuff. So that experience, that storyline, really kind of unpacks the damsel in distress, the princess in distress trope, and takes it a different way. And then when you eventually rescue the princess, she actually joins your party and is actually a pretty powerful fighter in her own right. Another trope that Chrono Trigger kind of digs at is the so-called prophesized hero, or the farm boy hero. And you know, typically in this trope, you have a naive backwater country boy or girl who has no political or military education, has no particular military skill, but they're thrust into the war of good and evil, and somehow they become the dominant hero. And it's all, it's all wholly unrealistic. Chrono Trigger attacks this prophesized hero trope really well with a character called Tata. So when the characters go into the past and they're fighting the villain who is called Magus, who's a kind of a sorcerer type character, They come to this village and they hear, you know, you hear in this village from the villagers that the sacred hero has arrived, or the prophesized hero has arrived. And then you later on learn that this is this little boy named Tata, who is not at all a hero. He's nothing. He discovered the hero's badge, and now everybody thinks he's the fated, you know, knight that's going to come and destroy the sorcerer. And at first, Tata had enjoyed the attention he was getting, and now he's totally scared because he knows that he can't fulfill the expectations that have been levied on him. Ironically, in the story, there is a character that fits the ideal of what we would think as this this ideal hero knight, fantasy knight type character, and that's Frog, or Glenn as his real name is. And while Tata is masquerading as the prophesied hero wearing the hero's badge, Frog is in hiding because of his own shame, and he feels shame, one, because he was turned into a frog and he looks ugly, but the other thing is he feels like he failed his companion Cyrus, who was killed by Magus. So you actually have an archetype fantasy knight hero, but he's not the one out in the spotlight because of his shame. And it's a very deep storyline, and it's very compelling storyline. And it those two characters, Tata and Frog, really flip the fantasy hero trope on its head. I think that when you play Chrono Trigger, you encounter a lot of things that start out very tropish. You encounter a robot who seems like at first he wants to be human, but then later down in the story, that robot has an encounter with other robots, and he's torn because he doesn't fit in with the other robots. So instead of just a robot, just a data-like character where a robot is just trying to be human, which is done a million times, you actually see a character who is torn between the human and the robot world and doesn't really fit in on either side. And just like with Frog and Tata, that tension makes the story, it makes the character just a lot deeper, a lot more compelling. And I think a lot of those story designs and the subverting of tropes in order to deepen the player's relationship with these characters is what makes that game and which makes that story so emotional and so touching, and it draws people in and it keeps people playing again and again.
Well, that's it for another episode. Thank you very, very much for listening. Next time, we're going to be looking at world building, which is a big subject, a popular subject for all fantasy writers. What are we going to be looking at specifically, though, JM?
So we've spent all this time talking about races and characters and backgrounds and having great ideas and having unique ideas. So next time, we're going to talk about how do you put all that together? And more importantly, how do you get that into your story, into your prose, in a way that is approachable and appreciated by the reader? So you don't want to overwhelm them, but you want to make sure that you're conveying the right amount of information in an interesting way. So we're going to talk about building a world, and we're going to talk about presenting it in the prose.
It's going to be insightful. Of course, we want to hear from you. If you've got questions about world building, send them to us. We'll try and get through them as much as we can. But we'll definitely be picking the best one and covering that one.
Like last time, send us your questions and we'll. So the question doesn't have to be tied to the topic.
Hey.
And then, of course, like last time, we're reaching. Give me a second.
Shut up.
Cat needs to compose itself.
So send in your questions, anything fantasy related. It doesn't have to be related to world building, but if it is, all the better. And we'll pick one to discuss at the beginning of the episode, and the the winner will get a free Kindle copy of my book, In the Valley of Magic, which I spoke about in this episode, my short story novel, so to speak.
Very nice indeed. What's the email address then, JM? You don't know our own email address. It's thefantasywriterstoolshed@gmail.com.
And we can be found on Facebook at facebook.com/fantasywriterstoolshed. No, the just Fantasy Writers Toolshed on Facebook.
Nice one. Thanks for listening and hit that subscribe button.
Yep. Thank you. See you next time.
See you next time.